Hello to everybody. Thanks. Welcome to this second session of today's conference on striking the balance between inflation and growth. Some of the previous panelists and keynote speaker, Kamal, have already referred to the spectacular Indian growth performance. India is this year expected to grow at about 8.2% according to the latest IMF data, and it expanded at a rate of over 10% last year. This is, as Professor Basu was arguing, there are still people who complain about this 8% figure, and yet it is three times the U.S. Economy growth rate for this year. In contrast, also other advanced economies, not just the U.S., have been experienced greater than anticipated weakness. In Europe, there is renewed financial volatility stemming from concerns about euro area periphery. And yet, despite this very spectacular growth performance, there are in India, not just in India, but also in other emerging economies, of course, there are inflation pressures that have become increasingly broad-based, reflecting a higher share of food and fuel in consumption, as well as accelerating demand pressures. And clearly the challenge for India is to steer the course so as the economy is put on a sustainable growth path, so that the economy can preserve its important contribution to global growth while solidly anchoring inflation expectations. And to elaborate more on this issue, we have a distinguished keynote speaker, Dr. Subir Gokarn. He is the deputy governor of the Reserve Bank of India. In that capacity, he oversees the work of a number of departments, like the monetary policy, the economic and policy research, the statistics and financial markets departments. And importantly, he's also a member of the G20 Deputies Forum, where he represents the Reserve Bank of India. Prior to joining the Reserve Bank of India, Dr. Gokarn had a number of prestigious appointments, like Chief Economist of Standard & Poor's, Executive Director and Chief Economist of CRISIL, and several many others. But Dr. Gokarn is very well known, so that I don't really need to spend a long introduction. So without further ado, Dr. Gokarn, I will give you the floor, and thanks very much for traveling all the way from India.
Moderator, panelists, distinguished guests from India and the U.S., I'd like to thank the CII and Brookings for inviting me to speak at this. Clearly a very important set of issues being discussed through the day. And my focus, as the title suggests, is on my domain, which is monetary policy. The Indian economy recovered relatively quickly from the financial crisis of 2008, but inflationary pressures emerged even in the early stages of the recovery in late 2009. Over the past year and a half, the challenge for monetary policy has been to contain these inflationary pressures without disrupting the recovery. The economy grew by 8.5% in the fiscal year 2010-11. Kaushik has already explained fiscal year to you, which is close to the five-year average pre-crisis growth. But year-end headline inflation was close to 9%. Well above tolerance limits. Meanwhile, global developments have implications for both growth and inflation trajectories in India over the coming months. In this presentation, I propose to talk about the key global and domestic factors that are shaping our growth and inflation outlook as a backdrop to discussing monetary policy actions and their impact. I will then briefly talk about the challenges to communication. Let me begin by talking about global forces. There are widespread perceptions and increasing concerns about the recovery in the advanced economies losing momentum. High energy prices appear to be feeding into a negative cycle of persistent unemployment and depressed housing prices in the US and UK, while the prospect of sovereign default and its real and financial consequences dominates the European policy discussion. In contrast, emerging market economies are showing symptoms of demand-driven inflationary pressures, which have, over the past several months, been exacerbated by rising global commodity prices. Apart from all the other things that are going on in the global environment, commodity prices have played a key role in India's inflation over this period. Consequently, their likely trajectory is going to be an important factor in influencing India's inflation path. Slides 1 and 2 provide some perspective on this. They display the correlations between the buildup of non-commercial long positions in four commodities, crude oil, copper on this slide, and cotton and soya beans on the next, and price movements. It appears that the trading positions, possibly driven by abundant liquidity, are contributing to recent price escalations, except in cotton, where temporary supply disruptions have been the main factor. Significantly, in recent weeks, there has been a reversal in long positions, which in turn is associated with softening of prices. In fact, this morning's news headline was the decline in pump prices across the states, the average number having come down by about 20 cents over the last week, and that's quite a significant change. If this trend persists, it will provide substantial relief for global inflation management, particularly for large commodity importers, including India. Further, although hardly a desirable way to control inflation, slowing global growth, in addition to reinforcing these favorable commodity price trends, will also help to moderate demand and keep capacity utilization low. This will contribute to moderating inflationary pressures coming from traded or tradable goods. Let me now talk about domestic growth prospects. 2010-11 was a year in which the economy continued its recovery from the impact of the financial crisis. Growth bottomed out at 6.8% in 2008-09, picked up to 8% in 2009-10, and further to 8.5% in 2010-11. Slide 3 shows two pictures of the growth trajectory. With reference to aggregate and sectoral GDP estimates, the trajectory in the graph suggests that the momentum is moderating somewhat, as the recent quarters, this is the bar chart, show declining year-on-year growth rates. The main contributor to this tendency is the industrial sector, which is the red line, which has shown relatively high volatility over the period displayed. It slowed significantly during the crisis, recovered sharply subsequently, and has recently begun to slow down. Looking at the industrial sector a little more closely, the graph displaying trends in industrial production provides some clues to its dynamics. The most volatile segments of the index, both of which are displayed on the graph, are capital goods and consumer durables. These are generally seen as being the most interest-sensitive components of the index, and the recent trend suggests the impact of contractionary monetary policy is having an impact. Along with softening commodity prices, this trend will contribute to bringing inflation under control by helping moderate demand pressures. Of course, industry associations, including CII, have been consistent critics of the monetary policy stance, arguing that it is slowing growth without really impacting inflation, which is being driven by supply-side pressures. I will address this critique both in the discussion on inflation and in the one on communication. In short, the domestic growth scenario suggests that the growth rate will moderate somewhat in the coming year. The Reserve Bank of India projects growth during 2011-12 to be 8% in its baseline scenario. From the inflation management perspective, this is not an entirely undesirable outcome. If it results in a significant reduction in the inflation rate, it will represent a soft landing, which in turn opens up the opportunity for reversal in the interest rate cycle. However, many unknowns stand in the way, and ultimately, inflation outcomes will determine the monetary stance. Let me talk in some detail about domestic inflation dynamics. Over the past year, the nature of inflation has changed in significant ways. Slide 4 provides the broad picture of the dynamics. Headline inflation began to accelerate in the second half of 2009-10 at a time when growth was still relatively sluggish. It stayed high through 2010-11, actually accelerating in the last quarter of the year. In the first 2 months of 2011-12, the pattern has persisted. However, the relative importance of the drivers of inflation clearly changed over the period displayed. Food inflation was the predominant contributor in the early phase, but a resurgence of energy prices in the post-crisis environment began to play an increasingly important role. The prices of non-food manufactured products, which the RBI views as a reflection of demand pressures and in some ways a measure of core inflation, began to rise noticeably in early 2010, but saw their rate of increase stabilize and even moderate somewhat in the third quarter of 2010-11. However, that pattern was short-lived, and the rate of inflation for this category surged in the fourth quarter, a momentum that has clearly persisted into the current year. The changing contributions of different drivers is very sharply brought out in the decomposition exercise displayed in slide 5. The analysis looked at recent patterns in terms of three periods of roughly equal length over the past 14 months, beginning April 2010. In the first period, food and energy reflecting classic supply-side forces were the primary contributors to inflation. Non-food manufacturing inflation, which to the extent that it represents demand pressures, was not insignificant, suggesting that pricing power was present. In the second period, the weight of the contribution shifted dramatically towards commodities other than energy. Cotton was a big factor there. The contribution from food moderated a bit, as did that from non-food manufacturing, suggesting that the pass-through or generalization, what we refer to as generalization risk, was moderating. However, this pattern was short-lived, as I said. In the last period, energy returned as a major contributor, and the sharp increase in the contribution of non-food manufacturing indicated that producers were able to pass on higher input costs without too much difficulty. The strength of the pass-through in this period indicated that demand conditions remained quite robust, even as some early signs of moderation were coming through the production estimates and feedback from industry. I want to put particular emphasis on food price dynamics, as I believe that this is likely to be a significant factor in the medium term. Although the overall contribution of food inflation moderated over the past year, there are structural demand-supply imbalances at work, which will keep the pressure up in the absence of large and sustainable increases in supply. The phenomenon is demonstrated in the graph in slide 6. The main point that the graph makes is that prices of protein sources have deviated sharply from their trend in recent years, that is the red line, and show no signs of reverting to it. By contrast, while prices of other foods have also shown periodic deviations from the trend, but they have generally reverted. The pattern has, of course, contributed to high volatility, as the slide also demonstrates. Volatility in food prices does have a welfare-reducing impact, but in the current Indian context, the much greater concern is the long-term nutritional impact of elevated protein prices. We had some reference to nutrition in the previous session. At a time when the combined impact of demographic transition and income increases is generating enormous demand for proteins, the supply chain is clearly struggling to meet this demand. To conclude this part of the discussion, let me bring in the issue of inflationary expectations. The persistence and recent acceleration of inflation has clearly increased the risk of expectations becoming unanchored. The RBI monitors short-term expectations through household surveys. Recent surveys have reinforced the perception that household expectations are moving up. Food prices play an important role in this process. But whatever the causes, the impact on wage setting in both explicit and implicit contracts cannot be dismissed. However, the relative stability of the long-term or 10-year yields on government securities suggests that expectations over this horizon remain anchored. This is reinforced by our regular surveys of professional forecasters, who also indicate no loss of confidence in a moderate inflation scenario over the medium and long run. Let me now talk about monetary policy actions and transmission. The current cycle of contractionary monetary policy was initiated in the context of two important factors. First, there was an enormous volume of liquidity in the domestic financial system as a result of policy responses to the crisis, which also took policy rates to very low levels. Second, even as the early signs of recovery were visible, inflation tendencies had also begun to show. All this was happening in a global environment which was still quite turbulent and uncertain in late 2009 and early 2010. Slide 7 shows the trajectory of policy instruments, the three instruments that we conventionally use, the repo, which is the red line, the reverse repo, which is the green line, and the cash reserve ratio, which is a quantitative instrument, the purple line. The trajectory of policy instruments in the pre-crisis, crisis, and recovery periods. In contrast to the very sharp and quick actions on rates and liquidity that were taken in responding to the crisis, the recovery has been characterized by a much more calibrated approach. This was motivated by considerations related to the factors that I mentioned earlier. A more aggressive response to the incipient inflationary pressures may have been warranted under somewhat more predictable domestic growth and global scenarios. But in both these respects, the situation in early 2010 was nowhere near stable or predictable. A calibrated approach, which was essentially a relatively frequent series of small rate hikes, was seen as the best way to balance the potentially conflicting objectives. In the early phase of the cycle, surplus liquidity conditions persisted, which clearly made transmission of policy rates through to transaction rates very sluggish. From this perspective, the early actions were essentially a signaling effort accompanied by steady moves to eliminate the liquidity surplus through CRR increases. By the middle of 2010, the liquidity scenario had moved to a deficit and transmission became much stronger. Slide 8 shows the immediate impact on the call rate, which is effectively operating target of monetary policy, of a change in the liquidity situation. That transition happened actually as a result of the process that Kaushik mentioned, the large realizations that the government received from the 3G auctions, but it was a process in motion and would have happened in any case. As soon as we saw the liquidity scenario change, transmission strengthened quite significantly. And the strengthening of transmission was visible across a variety of financial market segments. Slides 9 and 10 provide some illustrative evidence of this. In slide 9, the call rate and the so-called collateralized borrowing lending operations rate, essentially a secured short-term channel of liquidity management, are shown with reference to the reverse repo corridor. The transmission intensity is quite clear, with the added dimension of movement from the lower bound of the corridor to the upper bound as liquidity conditions tighten. Slide 10 shows the yield on 10-year government securities and that on 5-year AAA rated corporate bonds from the same perspective. Transmission is visible here as well. Of course, the banking system is by far the most important intermediary in the Indian financial context, and what banks do matters a great deal. Significantly, a similar analysis of transmission through bank lending rates does not suggest that it is as strong as that in markets. Slide 11 displays the dynamics of bank lending rates in response to policy rate changes in both the expansionary and contractionary cycles. The sensitivities do not appear to be very strong. Rates did not come down very sharply in the expansionary phase, and while they are increasing in the contractionary phase, the magnitudes appear to be small. Aggregation problems may be masking some of the impact. In the RBI's consultations with industry, the fact that banks are aggressively passing on rate increases is often alluded to, which is undoubtedly intended as a complaint, but is entirely consistent with monetary policy objectives. Finally, in the context of monetary actions and transmission, let me address the issue of real rates. One consistent critique of the monetary stance, that it has been behind the curve, is based on the criterion that real rates have been and still are negative. Of course, this leads to a usually inconclusive debate on what the deflator should be. Widespread perceptions that real rates are negative are likely to impact both spending behavior and expectations. This then leads to the more operational issue of whether rates are to be brought into positive territory relatively rapidly or gradually. Slides 12 and 13 provide some perspective on the real rate issue. As slide 12 shows, with the recent acceleration in inflation, many real rates, measured in the most simple way of subtracting either current headline inflation or core inflation from the nominal rate, are negative when the headline inflation is used to deflate. The picture changes, but hardly decisively, if core or, as I've said earlier, non-food manufacturing inflation is used. So going by these indicators, it may appear that the policy stance is not contractionary enough. However, when we look at some other measures of real rates, specifically bank lending rates as depicted in slide 13, the picture is a little different. Allowing for differences in risk and other differentiating factors for prices, real rates are significantly positive. As I said, this is a criterion on which the debate in the Indian context is yet unresolved and is keeping some of my colleagues in the research departments fully engaged. The point that I would like to make is that at least in terms of a large proportion of financial transactions, real rates are positive. It remains a matter of judgment whether they are lower than they should be, and if so, how quickly the necessary adjustment should be made. That judgment is partly related to the issue of expectations. Looking back over the past year and a half, the balancing act between growth and inflation can also be seen in a slightly different way. There is also a trade-off between minimizing the sacrifice of growth and not letting expectations run out of control as a result of inflation persistence exacerbated by new shocks. In the run-up to its recent annual policy statement, the RBI made an assessment that this had indeed emerged as a risk. Against a backdrop of firm and possibly rising commodity prices, the prospects of inflation going down soon were seen as not being very high. This supported the decision to send a stronger signal of commitment to bringing inflation under control. However, in our baseline projections, the cumulative impact of the tightening that has been done over the past few quarters, that is, the call rate has actually moved up by about 450 basis points in a little over a year, was likely to soften both growth and inflation in the second half of 2011-12. If this trajectory materialized as anticipated, the monetary stance could then respond accordingly. But ultimately, as I indicated earlier, the stance is going to be predominantly determined by the actual and prospective inflation outcomes. Let me conclude with talking about issues of communication. This is an enormous challenge at the best of times, which becomes even more complex in circumstances like the current ones. Let me briefly address two sets of issues to which a lot of thought is being given. First, there is a concern with forecasts going wrong. Having been an analyst in my previous position, I'm quite used to making frequent changes in forecasts as new information emerges. The difference in this position is that actual decisions with huge national consequences have to be made on the basis of forecasts that might be very short-lived. This poses risks to credibility because actions consistent with one forecast may not be equally so with a revised one. Apart from suggesting improvements in forecasting methodology, which is really a long-term process, there are immediate implications of this problem. One is to make better and more explicit assessments of alternative scenarios and then make policy decisions taking into account the risks associated with different scenarios materializing. In effect, this is being done, but perhaps a communication strategy around it needs to be fine-tuned. Second, there is the issue of communicating the goals of monetary policy. For a variety of reasons, we have chosen not to commit to a formal and explicit inflation target, which has many advocates in the country. There is a credibility risk to not being held accountable to a single target, but there is also a risk to regularly missing that target, even if it is due to factors outside the control of monetary policy. But that does not mean that some clear and, most importantly, achievable goals should not be articulated. We attempt to do this with every policy statement and look very carefully at feedback and public comment and debate that appear to have read messages different from what we intended and how we can sharpen it. In this connection, the growth-inflation trade-off and sometimes conflicting perceptions of it is a significant issue. Going by theory and empirics, the trade-off is essentially a short-term one, with monetary policy aiming to keep growth as close to its long-term or structural trend as possible. Contractionary policy will slow growth down only to the extent that the economy is growing beyond its capacity, provoking inflation. It cannot, in terms of this framework, have any significant impact on the trend rate of growth. In fact, long-term growth can only be helped, not hurt, by low and stable inflation. However, much of the debate tends to view any slowdown in growth resulting from an anti-inflationary monetary stance as a long-term sacrifice, that is, a downshift in the trend. We need to articulate the distinctions involved more strongly, which has been done rather consciously in recent statements, but again, perhaps needs to be sharpened. Let me conclude with a few remarks. The inflationary situation is India's most significant near-term macroeconomic challenge. There are some factors, global and domestic, that are clearly outside the purview of monetary influence. But that doesn't mean that monetary policy does not have a role in addressing factors that it does influence. Demand pressures and the risks of inflation becoming generalized through expectations and price-setting actions. To the extent that growth may be impacted, it must be understood as a short-term trade-off with positive consequences for long-term performance. Finally, the contribution of supply forces, which I've highlighted with the example of proteins, but which also exert pressure elsewhere, can only be addressed by increasing supply. Measures to do this are an integral part of a long-term inflation management strategy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gokhan, for this very comprehensive treatment of the issue. I will now pass to introduce the panelists. To my left, I have Antoine Van Artmael. He's chairman and co-chief investment officer of Ashmore EMM. And he's, of course, also a trustee of the Brookings Institution, chairman of the International Advisory Council of the Brookings Institution, chair of the NPR Foundation, and a member of the board of NPR. To my further left, I have David Gordon. David is Eurasia Group's head of research and director of global macro analysis. Earlier on, he was the director of policy planning under Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. And prior to that, he served in a top position at the National Intelligence Council. And then to my right, to my intermediate right, I have Mike Hansen. He's a senior U.S. economist at the Bank of America and Merrill Lynch Global Research. And he has spent about 20 years as an economist in working on financial markets issues, the Federal Reserve System. He was, in fact, an economist with the Federal Reserve Board and also with the Federal Reserve of New York. And he previously had positions at Yale University and Wesleyan University. And then to my further right, I have my colleague, Ishwar Prasad. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and also a Tolani senior professor of trade policy at Cornell University. He's a very prolific academic writer. He's also very heavily quoted by the press. He has testified before Congress a number of times. His research has been quoted by the U.S. Congressional Record. So without further ado, and given that we are running a little bit late, I will give the floor to Antoine first. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I would like to look at inflation. I'm an economist by training, but really a practitioner and an investor from the point of view of someone who invests in India and emerging markets. Is inflation a problem in India? I would say yes. Is it an unmanageable problem? I would say no. I would call it an insidious problem. And I think you already said more or less the same in your presentation, Dr. Gokhan. Insidious because, not because there's any fear of hyperinflation, but insidious because the inflationary expectations, I think, now both inside India and outside India seem to be increasing. To put it bluntly, from having expectation of kind of longer term inflation below 5% or so, now it seems to be above 5%. And that seems to be something that is a bit scary. Now, why is that? And I'll come back to that. I believe it is because, in a strange way, policymakers, and this seems to be in central banks everywhere, seem to be underestimating what I would call the emerging markets factor on the demand side, not just in India, but in emerging markets in general. So let me come back to that. First of all, inflation in India, of course, is not a new problem. In fact, if you look over the last couple of decades, inflation in India, with the exception of hyperinflation countries like Argentina and Brazil, or Turkey and Russia from time to time, has generally been on the high side. And so what that means is, in my view, that in the eyes of consumers and in the eyes of investors, in the eyes of businessmen, India is always very vulnerable to higher inflationary expectations. That's one issue. Second issue is India is certainly not alone in having an inflationary issue right now. They have generally increased globally in emerging markets. And it seemed to me that policymakers were caught a bit unaware. I mean, of course, you know, the global economy came back, commodity prices would come back, everybody would know that. So there was a bit of a focus on the uncontrollable factors, whereas I think there could have been more focus on, and I'm talking about central banks in general emerging markets, on two factors that I believe are more lasting. One is the time, and this is true in China, it's true in India, it's true in many emerging markets. It seems that the time of this infinite labor pool that is very elastic and that would just supply labor at low cost forever and ever is coming to an end. It is not just short-term wage pressures. There seems to be something else going on with wage pressures moving up and staying high for some time to come. In other words, increasingly a perception of a less elastic trained labor pool. That's one point. Second point is that the emerging markets demand in India, in China, in emerging markets generally, for many goods. I mean, people know about cement and oil. And increasingly, people think about food. But I think something fundamentally has changed. With emerging markets now, and I'm not talking about purchasing power parity basis, but just on a straight basis, are now 37% of the global economy. Emerging markets are big players. And that has an impact in terms of the relentlessness of this demand, I think, as a global factor coming from emerging markets. So I think those are the two areas where I think research has to focus more. You know, as investors, whether we like it or not, we give scorecards. Now, it's very dangerous to give a scorecard, but the deputy governor is sitting here. But I would say generally, investors look at India as having a central bank that is conservative, that is very responsible, that is focused on inflation, that is rather independent. But also, perhaps in the most recent cycle, a bit overly cautious and not sufficiently preemptive. That's how I read the scorecard. Why? I think, you know, people were scared about the global economy. We were scared, everybody was scared about the global economy. And I think with India now playing a role as in the G20, I think maybe that sense became even more important. There was domestic political paralysis as a result of the scandals. There was the sticky food prices. The monsoon somehow also seems to have become different from, let's say, decades type of experience. So the earlier belief that the supply factors, the food, oil, were just a spike and would mitigate is being replaced, I think, by a new reality. So outlook, how do we look at it? Short term, actually, I'm not too worried short term for all the reasons that you have mentioned. You see the consumer demand for cars and real estate, capital goods coming down. Oil prices are down for the moment. The subsidies have diminished with the new diesel and kerosene subsidies being diminished. But of course, it has been replaced, as I think you already mentioned, in the monetary policy statements, which, by the way, I must say, are the clearest of any monetary policy statements that I read anywhere in the world. I think they're a model even for the United States, as far as I'm concerned. They're very, very good. And so that for all of those reasons, I think in the short term, I'm not that concerned. In the longer term, I'm much more concerned. And that is because of this insidiousness of, I think, the inflationary expectations. And the fact that somehow central banks in emerging markets do not do enough policy coordination and seem to be perhaps a bit more relaxed than they should be. Conclusion, two lessons. I hope I'm staying within my 5 minutes. Two
30 seconds.
Two lessons. First is we in the developed world, in the United States, have to get used to the fact that the free lunch we have had for a long time, because we basically had these very low prices, in fact, declining prices coming from emerging markets, compensating for the bad things we were doing. That free lunch is over, as I think wage increases are going to rise faster in India and China and other places than productivity, as they have not done in the past. Second of all, I think we, everybody, should be mindful, and I think this, in fact, has the seeds of a future crisis, should be mindful of the inflationary impact of emerging markets demand and specifically too easy consumer and real estate credit. So those are my two concerns.
Thank you very much, Antoine. I will leave the floor to David.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure to be here. We in Eurasia Group have spent a lot of time looking at the comparative response to inflationary pressures. And I contrast the exceptionally transparent presentation that Governor Gokhan made this morning with Premier Wen Jiabao's announcement that inflation is no longer a problem, basically because he unilaterally upped the target. We've actually had a research team that's just come back from China and came back with the message that internally in China, exactly the opposite is going on. And that even as the Chinese government is talking as if they have their arms around the problem, in fact, they're acting as if they have their arms less and less around the problem. I think that one of the interesting parallels between China and India here that shows a similarity is the speed by which the perception of risk has shifted at the political level from the growth side to the inflation side. And I think that is playing out very, very, very rapidly here. As I look out, I think the big question facing India is, can India sustain a high rate of growth absent inflation that is at an unacceptable level? And that's the challenge. I frankly am of the view that at the end of the day, that's not essentially a monetary policy challenge for India. It's much more likely to be a challenge in the wider structural reform category. And I think that as I look out over the near future, while I completely agree with Antonio's discussion of hyperinflation is not a risk here, I'm actually somewhat less optimistic over the near term, because while I think that partially because of institutional reasons, that monetary policy is more autonomous of politics. It's not fully autonomous, but is more autonomous of politics. I'm very worried that the loss of momentum, frankly, on structural reform is yet to be turned around. Now, this is an opportunity here, though, because if you look at the potential for reinforcing structural policies that could help facilitate the success of monetary policy here, there's a lot of room for complementarity. The question is, can you get to a momentum where serious entrenched interests that are basically blocking efficiency gaining moves, particularly in the commercial sphere. Can those be cast aside in a way that enables structural reform to reinforce the kinds of monetary policy instruments that Dr. Gokarn talked about? And there, I think it's a very tough issue to answer. I haven't seen yet a public discussion of these issues that has made that linkage in a sharp way. But I do believe that the politics of inflation is getting to a point where the government could be led to a stronger commitment to structural reform policies on issues like multi-brand retail and others. I don't know, and these are uncharted waters, but I do think that getting to a context in which 8-9% growth is consistent with low levels, 4% inflation or even lower, that's going to be much more of a context of what's going on the structural reform side rather than a question of monetary policy. But I will reinforce the point that my colleague made. I think that very, very open and honest descriptions of where the monetary challenges are, where the macroeconomic challenges are increasingly a distinguishing characteristic between India on the one hand and China on the other. And for that, Dr. Gokarn and his institution are to be congratulated.
Thank you very much, David. So I will now pass to Eshwar.
Good morning. Metaphors about war always makes things a lot more interesting. So let me talk about the battle against inflation and structure my remarks around four issues. The questions I'd like to talk about are, number one, what does the battle against inflation mean for India's growth prospects as well as the composition of that growth? Second, what are the right policy tools that should be used in conducting the battle against inflation? Third, what are the effects of the global economy and the global economic environment in general can have for both inflation and growth prospects in India? And fourth, how does one resolve the tensions, some of which have been referred to here, between the short-term policy concerns and the longer-term objective of generating sustainable growth? Sadly, I think my questions are going to be far better than my answers. But let me talk about the first two issues, which I think are really critical in terms of India's present economic juncture. India, I guess as an Indian, one should take some pride in this, that we got ahead of the rest of the world in terms of the inflation cycle. And while the rest of the world took a while to catch up and is now facing this problem more generally, we face this problem much earlier on as the global economic recovery started picking up pace. A lot of the inflation, as Dr. Gokarn nicely presented, has in fact been led by food price and broader commodity price inflation increases, and that's still the case. So this brings up a very difficult issue that virtually every emerging market is dealing with right now. How do you deal with a problem that fundamentally is not a monetary policy problem, but you know is going to become a monetary policy problem if you let it fester? In a country like right. India or China, about one-third of the average household's consumption expenditures are accounted for by food. For poorer households, it's even larger. So there is an important social stability element to this fight against inflation as well, because if you say that the overall inflation rate is not that large and it's largely food prices, you're dealing with a very significant segment of the population that is hurting because of food prices. In China, concerns about the urban poor who don't benefit from food price increases but get hurt by food price increases substantially are the real concern for the government. In India, of course, the effects of food price inflation into overall inflation have started picking up much earlier. In fact, overall inflation is now much higher. But it is a very difficult conundrum because ultimately, the Reserve Bank of India is to some extent forced to do what it should not be doing, and it knows it should not be doing, which is reacting to a supply-side factor with a monetary policy tool. So one set of questions is, what implication does this have? Because ultimately, the RBA's hands are tied because we are seeing the effects on broader inflation. One, what are the implications? Second, what other policy tools could be brought to bear on this issue? On the first, it's very clear that the sort of increase in the shift in India's growth pattern towards the industrial sector is going to be hurt by what the RBI is essentially being forced to do, which is deal with monetary policy tools in order to fight the inflation battle. And that, I think, is going to hurt India's overall economic shift from agriculture and services towards a more manufacturing-led economy. Now, one has to balance against that the fact, which as Dr. Kaushik Basu very nicely pointed out, which is that there isn't really a fundamental trade-off between inflation stability and sustained growth. Because ultimately, if you cannot control the inflation problem, it has implications in terms of social stability. And as we've seen in the U.S., it forces monetary policy and other policies to act that much more harshly in the future when inflation does take off. And as Dr. Gokaran pointed out, inflationary expectations are a very fragile matter, and expectations are already beginning to show signs of becoming unanchored. So this does put monetary policy in a bind, and this is where other policies like fiscal policy could have a much bigger role to play. India still has a public debt to GDP ratio over 60%. It's coming down. The trajectory at which it was coming down was sort of affected by the financial crisis, and reasonably so. But I think a lot more needs to be done on the fiscal front and in terms of other structural policy measures, rather than putting the entire burden policy measures on the Reserve Bank of India, which is largely what has happened. And ultimately, there is a reason for this. I mean, it's not just because Governor Gokaran is here, but the Reserve Bank of India is seen as a relatively independent and a fairly trusted and technically competent body. So as in much of the rest of the world, a great deal of the burden does end up falling on the central bank, which creates enormous problems. Now, of course, the global environment has complicated life for many emerging markets. With the low interest rates in the U.S., very deficient demand in the United States and other advanced economies, a lot of money is flowing towards the emerging markets, partly because they have good long-term growth prospects, but second, given that it's a very easy trade to do right now, given how cheap money is in the U.S. and other economies. Now, here, India is in a somewhat different position from what one thinks of as a broad group of emerging markets that are getting more capital than they know what to do with. India does need the foreign capital. We have a current account deficit that's approaching 4% of GDP, largely because of oil price increases, but there is a significant structural component to the current account deficit. So India cannot afford to shoo away that capital. Now, there are two sides to this, as for everything else. On the one hand, it means that the Reserve Bank of India is somewhat less restricted in the actions it can take on the monetary policy front. When the Chinese central bank tries to raise interest rates, or when the Thai central bank tries to raise interest rates, that immediately brings in a lot more capital, creating even more problems in terms of the inflation problem. The same is likely to be true of India, but we do have enormous needs for capital. Previous speakers have referred to the needs for infrastructure financing, for various other types of financing, and with the current account deficit that we have, we don't really want to scare off capital. Now, the other good thing about the external environment, given the weaknesses in terms of the advanced economy, export markets, is, of course, that India is not heavily dependent on export markets. It has been largely a domestic demand-driven growth pattern. So in that sense, I'm much more optimistic about India's growth patterns and the possibility of maintaining good growth. But the balance of growth, which monetary policy has a very significant effect on, I think is going to become the real conundrum as we move forward. And finally, in terms of the tensions, there are questions here about whether, in fact, there are false tensions in some respects. I've already talked about the relationship between inflation and growth. Ultimately, I think it's managing inflation, reducing the volatility of inflation, that ultimately is good for an economy to grow faster. There are also tensions in terms of policies that need to be undertaken. And in fact, India has been opening up its capital account, for instance. This might seem like a foolhardy or, in fact, crazy thing to do at a time when you're concerned about capital coming in, when you're concerned about foreign inflows adding to problems in terms of inflation management. But I think ultimately the Indian economy is becoming de facto much more open. And the question is whether that circumstance can be applied effectively to direct the capital towards more productive parts of the economy, perhaps through building up the corporate bond market, perhaps developing other channels through which that money can be absorbed and more effectively channeled towards India's growth prospects. So ultimately, I think unless we focus on the structural long-term problems and stop seeing them as in tension with the short-term concerns, and in fact view this, as was referred to earlier, as a sort of opportunity for putting in place what India really needs to do in order to sustain its long-term growth, I think we are in trouble. But I think overall, despite the difficulties the economy has faced during the global financial crisis and its aftermath, I'm very encouraged, in fact, that progress, although it has been very slow, has been happening. A lot more needs to be done, and I think this is a fantastic window of opportunity that, if grabbed, could really solidify Dr. Basu's prediction that India could become the third largest economy in the world. We're not quite there yet, but we're on our way. Thanks.
Thank you, Ashwar. Mike?
Thank you all for the opportunity to speak here today. There are many more people on the panel who have substantially more knowledge about monetary policy and inflation in India than I do, but in the, I guess, the spirit of the title and given my background in the Federal Reserve System, I'm going to hope to bring in a few comments very briefly, try to be a little more extemporaneous given the last speaker as well. Let's talk a little bit about the issues in the U.S. in terms of inflation and monetary policy and whether there might be any useful lessons for India as well. And it's certainly a legitimate question even to start there, right? So certainly the stage of development of two economies are extremely different. The composition of inflation is very different, right? In the U.S., about less than a quarter of the inflation is coming from either food or energy or things that are directly commodity-driven. My understanding, in India, it's more like 45%. So there's a real significant difference there in terms of the composition of the basket and how things like commodity prices, which show very limited pass-through impacts in the U.S. even today, have much more significant and direct impacts on India. Obviously an important difference there. I think, though, that what is, I think, a useful thing to keep in mind is from the institutional perspective, the evolution of monetary policy in the U.S. shows that the policy that's now in place in India, as I understand it, actually is really very well established and made some really important gains. The U.S. sort of didn't learn it a hard way. Right now, of course, having worked at the Fed, I don't ever get the chance to say this, of course, but I don't speak for anyone at the Fed. Right? Let's make that very clear. I do think that there are two main innovations that we've seen basically since the great inflation in the 1970s in the U.S. in terms of monetary policy that have been learned by a number of central banks around the world. And I think India is also one that clearly has learned these lessons. I think the first is the importance of a commitment to fighting inflation. I think what if you look at the U.S. in the lead up to the inflation we had, certainly in the 1970s, is that you had a strong belief amongst policymakers, and you've heard several people talk about it on the committee here, that there might be this trade-off or this very significant sacrifice ratio that constrains the ability of policymakers to actually be aggressive on the inflation front. And I think one of the things we learned coming out of the Volcker disinflation is that fundamentally a strong commitment by a central bank to fight inflation is actually a positive in the longer term for growth, even if it does mean some near-term costs. And certainly in the case of the U.S., the costs were substantial. It was the largest recession up until the most recent one over the post-war period. The fact that the central bank established independence, I think, is essential, gets at some of the issues that was raised here earlier, because it means that the central bank has some ability to push back on fighting problems that aren't fundamentally theirs. And I think that's a very important constraint that potentially is being faced by a number of emerging market central banks today. I think the second set of lessons historically from the Fed didn't happen in the Volcker or even the Greenspan period, but it's happened more recently, and I see it reflected in the nature of the speech today and some of the publications I've seen out of the Reserve Bank of India, is a commitment to transparency, to communication, to openness. Right? So we now understand that monetary policy doesn't work by surprising the markets especially well. It works by guiding the markets. Right? It works by guiding the public. It works by guiding other members of the policy committee. Policy community. And in that sense, I think this is a lesson that's been gradually learned in the U.S., has been implemented more recently by Chairman Bernanke, but clearly is already in place in India. And I think that's an important contributor to why we should expect monetary policy lessons that were very costly in the U.S. to potentially be much less costly in India. Now, the second thing I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about was what's happening currently in monetary policy, not just in the U.S., but also amongst some of the larger industrialized economies And think of the major central banks out there in terms of, say, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Federal Reserve, clearly are following policies that are very different than what we're seeing in most emerging markets or even some of the commodity-driven developed economies out there today. Right? And the reason for that, I think, is actually fairly simple, in that we're at fundamentally different stages of the business cycle. So the three economies that I just mentioned, the U.S., the EU, and Japan, account for slightly more than 50% of the global economy in terms of overall global GDP. Of course, it was a bit more than that if you go back 3, 5, 10 years ago. But the growth of the emerging market economies is obviously shedding that. Yet these three economies will account for less than 25% of global growth that we will see this year. Right? These economies are growing extremely slowly relative to even their own historical norms. And of course, you know, in the U.S., we're struggling to get now 2% growth. We saw 1.9 in the first quarter. We're tracking probably a one handle here in the second quarter, right? We was already alluded to earlier the fact that 15 years ago, the thought of having 8%, debate about 8% growth in India would be remarkable. If we were to get 2.8% growth in the U.S., I think we'd all be very happy right now, right? We're very much at a different stage in the cycle, and this is why policy remains very accommodative in the U.S., and throughout most of the other major central banks, you're seeing obviously some concerns in the ECB. I think this reflects a difference in the fact that the ECB has a single mandate, the US has a dual mandate. In the ECB, you have much stronger channels through pass-through, less so in the US. In the US, the main mechanism through which monetary policy affects the economy is through interest rates. And I think this is potentially a difference between India and the U.S., where I think the banking sector and credit creation plays an important role in the U.S., but plays a much bigger role in both Europe, but also in a number of emerging markets, including India. Right? And so in the U.S., much more of a focus on the interest rate channel, and Fed's policy has not been designed to print money for the sake of printing money. Right? If you think of what the Fed officials, Bernanke on down, have all been talking about, it's how do we try to bring down interest rates in a more persistently or longer term and use that channel of transmission for monetary policy. Because let's be honest, given the state of the financial sector in the U.S., particularly the housing market, flooding the economy with liquidity isn't really going to do a whole lot. And, of course, if you step back and look at the data, we're not really doing that in the U.S. anyway. If you look at M2 GDP growth since the beginning of the financial crisis, it's averaging about 5.5%. You look over the same length of period before the crisis, it was closer to 5.75 or 6%. So even though we've had a big expansion of the Fed's balance sheet, it's all just going right back to the Fed in terms of banks depositing it back at the Fed earning 25 basis points. And so in that sense, it's a very different setup now. And the lessons are not so applicable between what's happening in the U.S. and what's happening abroad, certainly in India. There's been some discussion about the need for coordination. I think that certainly is true. But I don't think we can let that mask the fact that we have economies at different stages of the business cycle, and that warrants different domestic policy responses, even given the fact there are some international spillovers right now. And I think to India's credit, the fact they have a more flexible exchange rate regime, was alluded to how other central banks do not, really allows the central bank to have the flexibility to deal with the inflation problem and to not be simply linked to what may be a completely inappropriate policy for the rest of Asia, but might be very appropriate for some of the developed economies given where they are right now.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thanks to the panelists. From Dr. Gokern's keynote remarks and the discussion that has followed among the panelists, I mean, it's very clear that the issue of inflation in India is really a multifaceted one with a short-run component, a long-run or structural component, a domestic component, and a foreign component. And I was wondering, Dr. Gokern, because you are also a member of the G20 deputies, and there has been a reference by Ambassador Shankar to the role of the G20, what role you, first of all, whether, at what extent you might envisage a role for the G20 or for some form of a collective action in dealing with this global inflationary pressures, given that they are hurting in a way, especially emerging economies where the weight of food, fuel items is much higher. And of course, I would also invite the panelists to follow up. My aim would be to keep this first round of follow-up discussion relatively brief. So if you could stay within a couple of minutes, no more, so that we'll have time to gather a few questions from the audience. Dr. Gokern.
Well, I think the immediate sort of
area of potential is in commodities. And that's clearly a very sort of important item. This is the French, one of the two items that the French have put on the agenda for their presidency. So the idea that commodities and the charts that I showed suggested that there was a strong link between liquidity and commodity prices. This, I guess, it's a hypothesis that is being debated. But there is a strong perception, certainly in India, that that the financialization of commodities is a significant contributor to the price scenario. And that to the extent that we can have global coordination on reducing this, and obviously without killing, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, would be an important contribution. I don't have an answer to this. There is a working group that that is being chaired by the Japanese deputy. But I think it's a very, very important question. I think what is particularly striking about it is that when you have such a sort of disparity, a disconnect between the fundamentals and the pricing, and that's something I think which is really sort of hurting us in terms of, and when I say us, I mean India, yes, specifically, but also more generally emerging economies who are commodity importers, that you do have to then almost accept this as an inflation premium. This is Antoine's point that, is inflation becoming higher inevitably? But I think there is, I'm going to take the, and that's my G20 response, but I think there's a very important point that Antoine made about labor costs and productivity. If you take the Indian situation in relation to this massive explosion of demand for many commodities that happened with, increasing prosperity, other than food, there's very little in India that has not seen prices decline as volumes have increased. You name any commodity, any item, any product which has sort of been reflected in growing emerging consumption patterns. Consumer durables are the best example. But prices, and not just in real terms, in nominal terms, what you paid in rupees for a television set, for example, 20 years ago, is more than what you're paying for an infinitely more sophisticated television set today. Those basic sets aren't even being made anymore. Now, what that suggests is that you do have the opportunity to offset these sort of input costs, the inelastic input costs, through very significant increase in productivity. In India, that came about for a number of reasons. There was scale as volumes increased. There was competition as new players came in. There was imports as our trade barriers were eliminated. And there were other efficiencies that were gained in the system. So if clearly maybe food is not amenable to the same kind of increase, but I think we do have an opportunity. So I would be a little less worried about the inevitability of it. And that's why I think from a control viewpoint, the minute we give in to that perception that we have to live with it, that has its own danger. So just to address this point slightly separate from your question.
I would now proceed in a reverse order. So, Mike, do you want to react?
Sure. Just one thought. I think that's a very interesting point. And we often, when I end up talking with clients about inflation trends globally, this sort of issue very much comes up. And I think an unresolved question that I just want to put out there for other panelists to think about, and I'll be very brief on this, is if you look over the course of the 20th century, you have a very pronounced downward trend in real commodity prices. Mm-hmm. There certainly are some interruptions, right? Industrialization in the U.S., rebuilding of Europe, and now with the emergence of emerging markets. But the question is, should we expect that we would continue to see the general downward trend due to improvements in productivity and substitution effects? That means that this may not be a long-run persistent or an inflection point. Or is there something different about the environment going forward in the 21st century that we didn't see in the 20th century that we should be concerned there's an inflection point and we're going to have to potentially live with higher inflation or not? I simply put that out there as a question, but the historical evidence suggests that even with these periods of interruption, that downward trend continues because of substitution effects, productivity, and the like.
Thank you. Ashwar?
Let me take the broader coordination issue. I think the reality that Dr. Gokaran and other central bankers are going to face is that central banking, especially in the emerging markets, is going to get harder and harder. Yeah. It's not because we have a multi-speed economy now, which is something new, but what has changed is essentially that the world has become much more closely linked through financial flows, and fiscal policy in many countries, especially the advanced economies, but also the emerging markets, has gotten backed into a corner. So monetary policy becomes the first line of defense and also the first line of attack against problems. And these problems do tend to spill over. Now, central banks, especially in emerging markets, but also these days in advanced economies, already have a lot on their plate. And dealing with this issue of coordinating their policies, especially for countries that have large spillovers abroad, is going to create, I think, an additional complication. Now, it's hard to see how exactly this coordination would work, because ultimately a central bank is responsive and responsible to its domestic constituents and must focus on domestic considerations. And yet, once you take that proposition literally, which of course is the reality, it creates this very clear tension between the monetary policy actions among different groups of countries. So I'm having difficulty envisioning how exactly this coordination would work, because ultimately I think that ends up being a sort of red herring for what really needs to be done by each economy. Ultimately, if we think about the problems that need to be solved in the U.S., it's not really going to be solved by monetary policy issues, either the demand deficiency or the longer-term structural problems this economy faces. The same is true of China, the same is true of India, and yet we focus to such a great extent on monetary policy that I fear that we may end up trying to coordinate on something which is really not what growth is going to be all about in these countries.
Thank you. David?
Yeah, on coordination, I think it was much easier to coordinate monetary policy responses as we went into the crisis because the timing differential issue didn't come up. The global rebalancing issue didn't come up. So I would be very wary that we're really going to get any G20 coordination. On commodity prices, I think there are two fundamentally different hypotheses out there. The first hypothesis is basically that the commodity price increases are financially driven by liquidity. The second is that they're fundamentally driven by demand. And I think that there is a demand element to it, but I think the demand element has not been as strong as the financial element of it. And in a lot of commodities, particularly food, there are quite well-functioning global markets that can respond to price incentives reasonably quickly. And so even taking into account the effects of global warming that are certainly going to be negative for lots of countries, they're going to be positive for a lot of others, including the United States, Canada, Russia, that are potentially very, very, very large producers. So I think that this issue of commodity demand-driven inflation is one that may not be quite as profound.
Okay. Thank you. Antoine?
Yeah, if I could just respond to Dr. Gokhan. I was struck when I was reading the monetary policy statement of May by a sentence in there that was, I thought, extremely honest, where you said, quote, "The trigger for inflation was the sharp uptrend in international commodity prices. But the fact that these have quickly passed through into the entire range of domestic manufactured goods indicates that pricing power is significant. In other words, demand has been strong enough to allow significant pass-through." And I think this is where, and you mentioned it in your presentation, these various stages of inflation. We're now at a different stage. And what worries me, and the reason I call the inflation not unmanageable but insidious, is that if your economy is already vulnerable to higher inflationary expectations, and if, you know, you could make the argument, yes, based on if you just look at manufactured prices, the interest rates are real in positive terms. I think the fact is that most people in India feel that inflation is real. And my concern is that in addition to the declining labor pool, or trained labor pool, this fact alone, these inflationary expectations, will lead to kind of a more longer-term increase in wage pressures that is going to be with you for some time, and that then ultimately leads to this inflation premium.
Thank you. Dr. Gokhan, do you want to have a quick reaction, or shall we take questions from the audience? We still have 10 minutes to go, so we have been very efficient. Yeah. So I have a couple of questions from that side. May I ask the speakers to identify themselves, please?
This is Janmajay Sinha. I'm from the Boston Consulting Group. The one point that I just want to bring out to Antoine is that this discussion around the labor pool drying up in India is highly exaggerated. I mean, it's there are 20 million people at every age between 0 and 25. And the number of them who are in some form of disguised unemployment is huge. So if we were to talk about education and talent, and vocational training, that's true. But to talk about a shortage of labor which will dry up, analysis shows that in 2020, there will be 47 million surplus people in India. So, I mean, I don't think that that's something that I find resonating with me as I hear that.
We have another question from the table behind, I think.
Derek Scissors, Heritage Foundation. So the deputy governor, I don't want to go into detail because we don't have time, but I saw in your presentation multiple bits of evidence for financial market segmentation and that corporate borrowing costs are too far diverged from benchmark rates. Do you agree? That could make your answer really easy and we'd be done. If you do agree, is this, doesn't this complicate the inflation growth trade-off and prompt CII's criticism? And third, if it does complicate the inflation growth trade-off, what's to be done about addressing the excessive split between corporate borrowing costs and benchmark rates?
Okay, before leaving the floor to you, Dr. Gokhan, is there any other question from the audience?
My question is, what does this have to do with U.S.-India cooperation? We sit here on the eve of the financial partnership economic dialogue, and I'm not sure I'm hearing a role for U.S.-India economic cooperation. Seems to me this is just focused on what is happening internally to each one. I mean, we've sort of dismissed the G20. What's in it for U.S.-India economic cooperation?
Well, I think there is a rich set of questions. So, Dr. Gokhan, you want to go ahead first?
Yeah, I think the borrowing cost question, yes, I do agree, so we can end it there. But I think it's a critical sort of series of gaps in terms of the options that companies have to borrow money or to mobilize funds. And to some extent, that is creating the sort of absence of inadequacy of arbitrage across markets. So, of course, we've been talking for many years about bond markets, and that issue has become particularly acute in the context of what the ambassador said in the first session, which is a $1 trillion investment agenda for infrastructure. And that's not going to happen unless we have, we exploit every possible avenue for reducing the cost of capital relative to where it is, from efficiency. I mean, there's obviously a differential in terms of risk and duration and so on, but efficiency is key. And so market development is certainly a very, very important agenda, and we have a number of what I would say priority actions that we've identified in the course of the last few months which require some sort of coordination. One action was a change in the tax treatment of bonds for foreign investors. That's happened in part. It's not complete, but it's at least a start. There are some other actions in relation to making bonds more attractive to an emerging pool of resources in the pension and in insurance funds. So that's another convergence that we're trying to bring about. So at that point, I think once you you allow for a sort of fullness or completeness of markets, then obviously transmission becomes that much stronger. But that's not to say that it's not there now. And you know, you're right that producers are sort of complaining. Ishwar has also made the point about the impact on disproportionately on manufacturing because of the interest sensitivity of investment. So it's happening, and it's happening. But as I said, in the short term, it's happening in a way that is not inconsistent with our objectives. So when we look at the drivers of investment long term, cost of funds clearly is a factor. But I don't think that's an argument argument against being too worried about interest rate dynamics now, with which have both potential short term impacts. But you know, that's the position we operate on.
Thank you, Antoine.
Yeah, in answer to your question, obviously time will tell. Time will be the judge. But yeah, but why does it worry me? If I see wages go up in a way they didn't go up before, that's a signal that something has changed. And to me, the signal is twofold. One is there are some pressures for it to go up, which means there is a limitation on the supply somewhere in the system. And I think it's in the trains. Arvind Subramanian was earlier talking about basically the deficits in the educational area in terms of getting trained labor. I'm talking trained labor. But that's the part that's really important in the export sector. That's the part that's really important in the outsourcing picture, in your relative competitiveness in other countries. So to me, yes, it matters. I'm aware, both in India and China, that there are still lots of people. but the pressures seem to be there, and they seem to be growing. And it has to be from a supply issue. And I think on top of that, it is this question of, you know, with them having some, because of supply issues, some bargaining power, now the inflationary expectations, that combination is not lethal, but insidious.
Thank you. David?
Yeah, I think in terms of what are the implications of this for the partnership, I think that it's very, very much in the interest of the United States that India succeeds in grappling with this inflation growth tension, and that it's very much the case that I think in an expansion of economic and commercial ties between the two countries has as much to do with the larger structural reform agenda and the parallel moving on that I believe is crucial for addressing this long-term question of high growth without overwhelming inflationary pressures. That's gonna really shape what the opportunity set is for U.S. financial interests, commercial interests that are increasing but are wary. As we said, the interesting feature here is, despite the moves by the RBI, you haven't had the kinds of capital inflows that have been challenging a lot of other emerging market countries.
Thank you, Ishwar.
So let me confront head-on the skepticism about the U.S.-India partnership, and specifically about whether anything we have discussed this morning here or in the previous session has anything to do with that partnership. Ultimately, I think the question about whether India grows fast and how it grows has a very important implication, not just for the U.S., but for the global economy at large. There is a very clear growth model out there, one that seems to be succeeding, the Chinese growth model. The Indian growth model is looking quite different. And I think trying to see whether this succeeds, how this works, is going to have a pretty important implication in the global stage. Now, again, intrinsically, it's much easier and more exciting when talking about a partnership when two parties are at loggerheads with each other on either market access, currency disputes, and so on. There are no such natural conflicts between the U.S. and India. And yet, I think there is a role for a partnership essentially because these two countries are moving towards similar objectives on the global stage. They can work together in terms of creating a group within the G20 that I think can effect very important reforms. And ultimately, the reason we're talking about Indian policy, I think, is that the U.S. actually does have a role to play in terms of India's own transformation. One might argue that the Indian financial system has little to learn from the U.S. financial system. Perhaps it should go the other way. But India does want a better public debt management system, and perhaps because of the sheer volume of debt here, the U.S. has much more expertise on that. In terms of corporate bond market development, I think the U.S. does have technical expertise to offer. So I think both in terms of what the countries can learn from each other and what they can ultimately bring to the global economic stage, I think the partnership is actually going to be quite valuable.
Thank you. And Mike?
Just some very brief comments. I think most of the other speakers have done a good job of addressing the questions. And just again, on the question of coordination, which I think gets to part of the issue about, you know, what's the role for U.S.-India relationships. I think the first is, although India is one of the emerging market economies that is certainly less exposed to shocks in the global economy, there's little doubt that, as we often say, when the U.S. sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And so there's a strong incentive amongst emerging market economies, certainly amongst India, to make sure that the U.S. actually does get itself back on a sustainable recovery. That may require, but not solely be satisfied by some very accommodative monetary policy in the near term. I think the second aspect of that is keeping in mind that I do agree there's an important financial component of what's happening in commodity prices, and it has a global attribute to it. And it's something that central banks, I think, generally have somewhat of a limited control over, however. Quite frankly, it looks to me that it's less liquidity-driven per se. It's not like there's large amounts of money flowing out of the U.S. banking sector, for example, because the Fed has increased the amount of reserves held electronically at the banking system. We're not seeing explosive loan growth in the U.S. We're seeing that money just deposited right back at the Fed, as I mentioned earlier. What you are seeing, though, I think is a very important speculative component. And that's a very different challenge for central bankers. It's one where I think there's potentially more scope for coordination and something that I don't think has an easy answer to, but certainly is a place where emerging market economies and developed economies have some common interests.
Well, thank you. I think we are pretty much on time. So we may end this session. But before I do so, I would like to thank Dr. Gokarn for his keynote remarks and the panelists for joining us today. Thank you very much.